Good morning and welcome to this Mellon News event sponsored by the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. You'll be hearing today from a total of three speakers, three experts, who will be offering brief opening statements before the Q&A period begins. They'll be referring to information that is summarized in the news release that's available to you now on the website for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, and that's at www.cleanenergy.org. That's www.cleanenergy.org. It will also be available to you on PR Newswire today. Before we introduce our three speakers as a group and then individually as they deliver their opening statements, we'd like to invite the operator on the line to explain how it is that members of the news media can pose questions during the Q&A period that will follow the opening statements.
During the question and answer session, you may ask a question by pressing star and then one on your touchtone telephones. If you decide you would like to remove yourself from the queue, you may press star and then two. Again, in order to ask a question, it's star and then one.
And we will have the operator back on the line at the start of the Q&A period so that you can hear once again how it is that you can pose your questions if you're a member of the news media. And again, we do want to remind you that the Q&A period will in fact be reserved for members of the news media. Our three speakers today you'll be hearing from them in the following order. First of all, from Sarah Barzak, who is Program Director with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. Second speaker today will be Mark Cooper, who is a Senior Fellow for Economic Analysis at the Institute for Energy and the Environment at the Vermont Law School. He will be followed by former Nuclear Regulatory Commissioner Peter Bradford, who is an adjunct professor at the Vermont Law School. Mr. Bradford also has served as chair of the New York and Maine Utility Commissions. What we'll be doing now is proceeding to the opening statement from our first speaker, Southern Alliance for Clean Energy Program Director Sarah Barzak. Please proceed.
I'm Sarah Barzak, Program Director of Southern Alliance for Clean Energy's High Risk Energy Choices Program. Earlier this year, SACE intervened at the Florida PSC in the Nuclear Cost Recovery Clause process that reviews both Progress's Levy County proposal to build two new reactors and FPL's effort to build two new reactors at their existing Turkey Point nuclear plant near Miami. We're talking about four new reactors with projected construction costs of more than $34 billion, all for the state of Florida. We submitted expert testimony from economist Dr. Mark Cooper, who's on the line, and also Mr. Arnold Gunderson, which clearly showed that it is not economically prudent for the utilities to continue and that the completion of the reactors is currently not economically feasible. Hearings were held in September, and SACE was not alone at the table raising serious concerns about these utility proposals. SACE, along with other interveners that included business interests, urged the PSC to reject FPL and Progress's scheme to charge customers hundreds of millions of dollars for construction costs through an early cost recovery mechanism. This recommendation places an untenable financial risk on the backs of Florida utility customers. Some of the concerns raised at the hearing included a significant drop in consumer demand, Nuclear Regulatory Commission regulatory delays, and lack of consideration of the role that efficiency or renewables would play in Florida's near-term energy policy, just to name a few. Dr. Cooper and Mr. Bradford will discuss those issues in greater detail. Shockingly, the public was not even given an opportunity to speak at the hearings. And last week, the Public Service Commission staff issued a recommendation that provided the utilities with nearly all they asked for. We at SACE are very disappointed that the PSC staff failed to protect Florida families and businesses from these risky ventures. We hope that the PSC commissioners make the right choice to protect Florida citizens, not the big power companies, when they vote on this matter this Friday. SACE has consistently advocated for lower risk and lower cost resource alternatives to these new reactors in Florida, such as energy efficiency. The energy efficiency savings levels by Florida's largest utilities are appallingly low relative to other leading utilities across the country. SACE has also intervened in the Commission's efficiency goal-setting docket to advocate for meaningful efficiency goals. The staff recommendation is due tomorrow, actually, October 15th, with the Commission decision due October 27th. Again, SACE and other intervening parties put together a clear message to the PSC that Florida Power and Light and Progress Energy should not be allowed to dip into the wallets of Florida customers to pay for costly and risky new nuclear reactors years and years before they produce any electricity, if they ever even get built. The PSC commissioners can take the road of caution and slow down this process by denying FPL and Progress's scheme to pick the pockets of the ratepayers, By doing this, the PSC will protect Florida's families and businesses while forcing the utilities to rethink their shaky plans. Thank you.
That was the opening statement from our first speaker, Sarah Barzac, who is Program Director with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. We'll now proceed to our second of three speakers. He is Mark Cooper, Senior Fellow for Economic Analysis at the Institute for Energy and the Environment at Vermont Law School.
Thank you again. Good morning. I want to thank SACE for inviting me to participate in this news event today. I submitted written testimony on this matter on behalf of SACE to the Florida Public Service Commission in July. I have testified over 100 times before public utility commissions in 44 jurisdictions in the U.S. and Canada on energy and telecommunications, and perhaps twice as many times as that at the federal level in Congress and at federal agencies. I'm also the author of a report from June entitled The Economics of Nuclear Reactors, in which I found that it would cost between $1.9 trillion and $4.1 trillion more to build 100 nuclear reactors than it would to meet the need for an equivalent amount of energy, electricity with a combination of efficiency and renewables. And obviously, Florida would bear a piece of that burden. While it is true that the Florida legislature has created an environment that provides incentives to build nuclear reactors, the policies adopted do not give a blank check to the utilities, nor do they put a blindfold on the Public Service Commission. Utility investment must still be prudent, and the reactors must be viable in the long term. In my testimony, I showed that in light of recent developments in a number of areas, the reactors proposed by Florida Power Light and Progress Energy are neither prudent nor viable. I show that since the certificates of need were issued for the proposed reactors, marketplace, policy, technology, and financial factors have changed dramatically, all in a direction that undermines the long-term viability of the reactors. Building four nuclear reactors in a state like Florida, when projections for demand growth have declined sharply, the cost of the reactors have skyrocketed and are still largely unknown, the cost of natural gas has plummeted, and the nature and scope of carbon mitigation and compliance costs have yet to be defined at the federal level, this is not the moment, the prudent thing to do, not the moment to build new reactors. As a result of these changes, the financial risk of these proposed reactors has grown dramatically. The rating firm Moody's now considers the decision to build reactors a bet-the-farm decision, and utility consultants have concluded that getting out of the first wave of reactor building is the smart thing to do. The last time utilities made such huge bets on nuclear reactors, half of them went bad, and consumers were left holding the bag for huge cost overruns and canceled plants. My analysis now shows that it's a near certainty that consumers would be stuck once again for vast cost overruns. The utilities' backs are not against the wall. Load growth has slowed, and there are much less costly, less risky options available in the near term to meet the need for electricity and to provide for greater certainty before major decisions about large construction projects are made. The economic analysis presented by the utilities does not fully reflect the economic reality that these projects face today. The economic recession and the unfolding transformation of economic activity have pushed any possible need for the reactors out by half a decade or more. The reduction in capacity needed in 2017, the year before the first of these plants was projected to come online, the peak load for that year for Florida Power and Light and Progress is well over 4,000 megawatts less than it was deemed to be about 2 years ago. That reduction in needed capacity is the equivalent of approximately Turkey Point 6 and 7 and Levy County 1 and 2 combined. As a result, building these reactors is simply likely to result in excess and expensive capacity without even taking into account changes in federal policy. And in fact, when one looks at federal climate change policy, which was central to the original decision to issue certificates of need for these reactors, one finds that there is likely to be a dramatic different direction taken by federal policy. It was assumed that a big price would be put on carbon at the federal level, and that is all. In fact, if you look at the legislation working through Congress, yes, there may be a price put on carbon, but there will also be a number of policies that promote efficiency and renewables. As a result, the price of carbon that people are estimating for future years has declined dramatically. That key element of justifying expensive nuclear reactors has changed. There's also growing concern about execution risk of building these reactors. Price estimates have risen, the specter of licensing and construction delays has grown, and in a certain sense, Progress Energy set a record for being quick to delay. A mere 3 weeks after they signed their contract, they were denied a limited work authorization and now are looking at a 20 to 36 month delay. 23 days, and they're 20 to 36 months behind. These dramatic changes in the decision-making environment mean that the analysis presented by the utilities is centered on a completely unrealistic set of assumptions. If they were required to redo their analysis with the focal point reflecting less demand, lower gas prices, higher nuclear reactor costs, lower carbon costs, they would conclude that the plants are not economic. Now is the moment to cut the losses and avoid spending billions on plants that, at best, will impose large uneconomic costs on consumers and, at worst, will not be used and useful at all. Prudent action requires constant evaluation and reevaluation. I recommend that the Commission not allow future recovery of costs for development of these reactors because they are not feasible in the long term. I recommend a number of measures that the Commission should take and require the utilities to take to improve the evaluation process going forward to avoid making a huge mistake. These include the need to ensure that critical economic assumptions are up to date and reflect the full range of potential outcomes. Second, to factor excess capacity directly into the decision framework. Third, to integrate resource planning into the feasibility analysis. And fourth, to pin down the cost of nuclear reactors with binding cost estimates so that ratepayers are not exposed to a continuous process of cost overrun. That concludes my opening statement. I look forward to answering your questions during the Q&A period. Thank you.
That was the opening statement of our second speaker, Mark Cooper, Senior Fellow for Economic Analysis at the Institute for Energy and the Environment at Vermont Law School. We'll now proceed to our third and final speaker before the Q&A period. He is former Nuclear Regulatory Commission member Peter Bradford, an adjunct professor at Vermont Law School. He also served as the chair of the New York and Maine Utility Commissions and has advised many states on utility restructuring issues. He testified in the early cost recovery case before the Florida PSC for one of Progress Energy's largest industrial users. Peter?
Thanks, Scott. As you've said, I testified over the last 2 years in the Progress Energy proceedings on behalf of PCS Phosphate. The changes in the circumstances that confront the Levy project over the last 12 months are no ordinary year-to-year fluctuations. No other year in my 40 years of experience with the electric industry has seen such a combination of demand drop, economic slowdown, capital market contraction, natural gas price decline, and potential changes in national energy legislation. In addition, the Levy County project is delayed by a minimum of 20 months. These changes are fundamental. They've altered the structure of long-term electricity and energy markets in Florida and elsewhere. If they were ordinary fluctuations, a reasonable likelihood would exist that the next year or two would erase them, restoring Progress Energy's 2008 view of Florida energy markets. But no such likelihood exists. Raising rates at this time to build unnecessary and expensive power plants will harm Florida's economy and job growth. It'll hurt the Commission's public support, and it'll harm the relationship between Florida utilities and their customers for years to come.
That was the opening statement of our third speaker. Again, Peter Bradford, an adjunct professor at the Vermont Law School, also a former Nuclear Regulatory NRC Commission member. He also served as the chair of the New York and Maine Utility Commissions. With that, we're going to proceed to the question and answer portion of today's news event. I want to stress again that the Q&A period is reserved for members of the news media. Operator, can you go through the instructions for how it is that members of the media can pose their questions?
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and then 1 on your touch-tone telephones. If you decide you would like to withdraw your question, please press star and then 2 to remove yourself from the list. We ask that you please limit yourself to one question and a single follow-up. If you do need to ask an additional question, please know that you may press star and then 1 to rejoin the queue. One moment while we poll for questions.
And while we're waiting for our first question, we do want to make sure that you know that the release, that news release that summarizes the key points being discussed by the speakers today in this news event, available to you on the website for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy at cleanenergy.org. Again, that's www.cleanenergy.org. You can also find the same news release on the web via PR Newswire. It's available to you in both places at this time. We also will be explaining how it is that you can hear a streaming audio replay of this news event in its entirety for those of you who may have missed some portion of it later on during the Q&A period. At this point, operator, let's proceed with our first question.
Our first question comes from Julie Patel from Sun Sentinel.
Hi. Thanks for holding the news conference. I just have a question about the cost overruns for nuclear plants. Is there, one, a sense of how many projects have experienced overruns so far? How many of the reactors nationwide? You may not have that, but if you do, that'd be helpful. And then, two, do you have a sense of how many states have caps on, caps on the cost of nuclear reactors? So, if they've set a limit. And I guess that question would go to any of the three folks.
Well, this is Mark Cooper. Since I've, in a certain sense, that was what the first question was, what my report was about. If you look at the June document, the economics of nuclear reactors, what I discovered was that starting from 2001, when the nuclear renaissance was born, in the Bush administration and in the minds of the vendors, there were a series of very low cost estimates put out, a $1,000 to $2,000 per kilowatt per megawatt. And over time, what happened was those estimates doubled and tripled. And so, if you look at the current estimates, they're much higher than that. That's the first phase of sort of the escalation of the price estimates. What we've also seen is that if you look at the 20 reactors that have applied for licenses, virtually every one of those reactors has suffered adverse events. About half of them have been canceled, suspended, or delayed. A number of them, four or five of them, they all have incurred dramatic cost increases. Several of the utilities that are proposing to build them have suffered negative financial advice, downgrades or negative advice. And the farther along that they are in the process of development, the more likely they are to have received negative advice. So this all goes to the question of the execution risk. And what you have to realize is that when a utility has a downgrade of its bond rating, the cost of electricity goes up because the cost of capital for that utility goes up. Lenders insist on higher interest rates to take their debt, and that raises the cost to consumers. And so the execution risk, delays, and financial downgrades all are adding to the escalation that we've seen, creating a tremendous likelihood of very negative impact on consumers in terms of cost. And that's part of the sort of the ongoing analysis that commissions really have to keep in mind. They have to be sensitive to what's happening in the real world. And over the last 2 years, the nuclear renaissance has basically gone off the tracks. And the impact of forging ahead is going to be a dramatic cost on consumers. The second, I think I got your second question too. Did I?
No, the second question was on caps. I have another question. How many states have allow early recovery, and how many states have limits on how much can be spent on the reactors?
Again, to my knowledge, mm-hmm.
If any.
Yeah, no, to my knowledge, there are no caps, although some have recommended it, or at least incentive schemes to try and control costs. But the irony is that in no state that I know of is a firm price been offered. So it's a combination of the utilities have not yet written down a firm price and that they say this is what it will cost, because they don't know what it will cost. And the sensitivity analyses have very high possible high-end costs. So the utilities haven't committed to binding cost projections, and that's very much the case in Florida. Public service commissions have not yet imposed caps or even incentive schemes to give the utilities the incentive not to go above their projected costs. With respect to early recovery, it's my understanding that early recovery is being collected in Florida and Georgia. It's allowed in South Carolina, but the utilities have not yet asked for it. In Texas, the Public Utility Commission doesn't regulate rates anymore. The South Texas project, I believe some costs are being recovered from the city of San Antonio, but the investor-owned part of it, there's no way in Texas to recover, to have early recovery of costs. And Sarah or Peter can correct me or add if they have more current knowledge.
Yeah, as to caps, a number of states capped the costs of nuclear plants during the period of cost overruns in the 1980s. New York did it at Nine Mile Point. Pennsylvania did it. California did it with regard to the Diablo Canyon plants. But your question spoke of cost overruns. And as Mark indicated, we're really not there yet with this round of plants because they haven't started construction. So the process he's describing is a process of upward revision of cost estimates. They aren't classic cost overruns because no one's broken ground yet, and so there isn't a cost estimate as of the beginning of construction to have a cost overrun against. What you're seeing instead is this process of very rapid escalation of cost estimates. As to early recovery from customers, in Missouri, the utility sought to overturn legislation that prohibits that. They did not succeed in the legislature, and as a result, that plant did not go forward. So there's no place outside of the group of southeastern states that Mark recommended that's allowing early cost recovery for a nuclear plant now.
Is there a follow-up question?
Our next question comes from Lynn Doan from SNL Financial.
All right, can you hear me?
Yes.
I was on mute. I apologize for that. This question is for Mark Cooper. You mentioned the estimates $1.9 trillion to $4.1 trillion to build 100 nuclear reactors across the country. And I was wondering if you made those same kinds of estimates on Florida in particular that we could use for this story?
Well,
maybe specific to the...
Yeah, that's tricky because the Florida utilities haven't yet presented an estimated cost per kilowatt hour, and that's what that number is based upon. That is, frequently when the analysis is done, people will calculate the levelized cost per kilowatt hour, which factors in not only the construction costs, but also the finance costs and all the operating costs. So the Florida utilities have not calculated that number, and actually that's one of the oddities of the case it's so odd to try and propose a project and get cost recovery for a project that you don't even have a firm estimate of the cost on, that Florida Power and Light sort of invented a new way to do this, which I do not think has been used in Florida before. They sort of back into trying to show that it would be less expensive based upon a series of assumptions that are completely incorrect today.
One quick question as a follow-up. Was this analysis that you did, was this commissioned by the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, or was this something that you were studying before?
Well, there are two pieces of analysis. The big document was not commissioned by the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. I did prepare testimony for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy in the docket, and so the analysis I've given you about the change in conditions, about the risk of the plants being non-viable, resulting in large uneconomic costs, that was new for SACE. So there are two pieces of analysis. The original study was not. That was specific. I've, needless to say, gone on and done analyses as I suggested in Texas and a couple other places. You could do the arithmetic if you wanted and take 4% of my large estimates, and you would come out with $75 to $150+ billion of excess costs in Florida. But that is a little bit too back of the envelope-y. I would like to see a firm estimate of the levelized cost per kilowatt hour, because I know what the levelized cost per kilowatt hour for efficiency is. I've got a lot of studies about that. I know what the levelized cost per kilowatt hour for the alternatives is. That's a better basis for actually offering the kind of number you asked about.
Our next question comes from Housley Carr from McGraw-Hill.
Hello. I was wondering if one of you might comment briefly on what you think are sort of the realistic prospects for the PSC not giving Progress and FPL what they want, because haven't they already signaled essentially their support for the nuclear projects and also for acknowledge that there is state law that allows this?
This is Sarah Barzak with Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. I think the way to address that question is that what the PSC commissioners are going to vote on Friday is not whether or not this project goes forward. It is whether or not they can recoup Progress and Florida Power and Light can recoup several hundred million dollars to charge the ratepayers, their customers, for pursuing these new reactors now. And what SACE has been advocating is that this, since this is early on in the process, since neither utility has really fully spent billions of dollars on these reactors yet, this is a chance for the PSC commissioners to slow this process down, to be cautious, and to, if they deny the utility's request and they reject this, it can give the utilities the signal that maybe they should step back and look this over again, and perhaps right now is not the time. The PSC already approved the need determination for these reactors, so that has passed. What we're looking at now is, have these costs been spent prudently? And we argue, and Mr. Bradford and Dr. Cooper argued in their testimony for their clients that it was not prudent because a number of things have changed since that need determination case. So, is it realistic that the PSC is going to vote to reject the utility's request? I don't know. I would say, listening to the testimony, I was at the hearings. There were a number of interveners at the table, not just SACE. Excellent arguments were put forward, and it would just be a step in the right direction for the PSC to be cautious and not give the utilities everything they ask for, which is essentially what the staff recommendation did that came out last week.
The legislation set up a balance. That is, it made it easier for utilities to proceed with certain kinds of power plant construction, including nuclear, once the commission had certified the need. But it retained customer protections in the form of a requirement that the monies be spent prudently, and also that the utilities continue to demonstrate the feasibility of their projects. The issue in this proceeding is, given all the changes that Mark and I, Sarah, spoke to at the beginning, have they demonstrated prudence and feasibility in light of this changed world of much lower demand, much cheaper alternatives? And our contention is that it's neither prudent nor feasible to require the customers to pay a lot of money early on for plants that they just don't need in the time frame proposed.
Okay, great.
I cannot handicap what the commission will do. I can only tell them what they should do. I can suggest that I have real concerns that these projects will not get to completion. And there's a strong case when you look at what has happened to projects that were better situated than these in terms of fewer projects in the state. Some already have partners. The two utilities have struggled to find partners. The balance sheets of the utilities compared to the size of the projects. And there are many projects that were better situated that have been delayed. And so my great concern is that we've started a process of throwing good money after bad here. In the last round of construction, a huge amount of money was wasted until people finally sort of recognized that the projects were not going to be used and useful, and they pulled the plug. So for me, I don't think the projects will get built, and I think they are wasting consumers' money by pursuing them at this stage. There are consultants to the industry, very prominent consultants, who have told people to get out of line and wait to see what happens, to get out of the first wave. There's no advantage to being there. And that's the kind of thing I would hope the Public Utility Commission would recognize. And the sooner they do, the less costly it will be for the ratepayers in Florida.
Great. Thank you.
Operator, I understand we have another new questioner, so let's proceed there.
Our next question comes from Susan Salisbury from the Palm Beach Post.
Yes. How much is demand down, and do you have any projection on how excessive this capacity would be?
Well, this is Mark Cooper. The demand reduction projected by Florida Power and Light for 2017, which is sort of the year where we have the farthest out overlap between the original projections and the 2009. They only project out 10 years. For Florida and Power and Light, it was down 11%. And if you do the math, including the reserve margin, that reduction alone was almost twice the size of Turkey Point 6 and 7. Progress projected less of a reduction in demand, and I think they were being too optimistic about that. And there's been, there's a great concern in Florida and a national recognition that the fundamental consumption pattern of American households is going to change because of a genuinely tipping point kind of event. If you look at the 10 years before 2007, which was the year that the estimates were used to certify these plants, from 1997 to 2007, were this massive housing bubble. It obviously burst. And the recognition that people will not be swapping out houses and getting bigger houses and filling them with more electricity-consuming appliances because they have to restore their household balance sheets are terribly out of whack. So there's a serious structural change that many economists believe is taking place. The savings rate is up, but it's going to take a long time for people to restore their household balance sheets. And so the current projection of excess capacity was substantial. The way I stated it in my testimony was that the peak that the utilities had projected for 2017, their summer peak, which was their highest peak, was moved out by 5 years in just the 1 year of 2009. And that hasn't taken into account what I believe is going to be the structural shift of demand growth. And so that's a half a decade. That's a lot of excess capacity. When you factor in what might happen at the federal level in terms of climate legislation, which would have a substantial efficiency and renewables mandate, my analysis showed that if it were aggressive, and we don't know exactly how aggressive it would be, you could push that same peak out for another decade and a half. So the risk of excess capacity is very, very large. Now, the utilities are responding to that by shedding existing generation, by jiggering their plans to build natural gas plants. But natural gas is cheap today, and I showed in my testimony that at least for a decade, the New York Mercantile Exchange has fairly low prices out for gas, and there's a tremendous increase in the resource base for gas because of new technology, and people think that technology is going to spread to the globe. So the cost of plowing ahead with these plants, of canceling much less expensive options, of not recognizing the efficiency, would make these plants a tremendous drag on the state economy and the ratepayers' budgets in Florida.
Thank you.
I understand we have a follow-up question, operator.
We do. We have a question from Julie Patel from the Sun Sentinel.
Hi. My understanding is that, I don't think I've talked to Sace about this, but that power plants at one point, nationwide, were more often paid for by the utilities and not the customers. But obviously, that's changed through different recovery clauses. I'm wondering if that was also, and also I thought of this because you mentioned Texas investors might be paying for part of the nuclear plant there. What about in the last round of nuclear plants? Were customers paying for was there a rate recovery for those construction costs that had started, for the projects that started the last time around?
Customers,
I'm not talking about early recovery. I'm
Customers pay for power plants. Ultimately, they bear the entire cost, especially in states where you have regulation. So in Florida and the Southeast, you do not have a restructured market. So ultimately, customers have always paid for the power plants. The question is, who bears the risk of building the plants? And traditionally, because utilities receive a rate of return on their used and useful plants, so a utility says, I want to build a plant, they build the plant, and then they put the cost of that plant, including a return on all of their investment, into the rate base. But they don't get to charge consumers until the plant is used and useful. And if you think about your daily life, almost 100% of the time, you don't pay for something until it's handed to you and you have the use of it. That is the way our capitalist economy works. Investors bear the risk of delivering the product, and when the consumer buys it, the investor gets back his initial investment plus a reasonable return. In the competitive marketplace, the reasonableness is imposed by competitive market forces. In regulated utilities, the principle was utilities bear the risk of building it. When they bring it as a used and useful product to deliver services to the consumer, they begin to collect the return of and on their capital. The utilities in the first round, the nuclear reactors were built that way. There was not, by and large, and Peter may know of some exceptions, but by and large, utilities were required to build them. When they delivered them, they began to recover the cost. And then the Public Service Commission also has to make sure that the costs were prudent, that they didn't, you know, spend money frivolously. What's going on now is an effort to change that pattern, to shift the risk of the construction period from the utility, who's being rewarded with his return on equity, to the ratepayer, and guarantee that the utility will get their money from the ratepayer up front, regardless of whether the plant ever is used and useful. That is a radical change in the allocation of risk. Should certainly lower the rewards that the utilities get. But my concern is that looking at the characteristics of the marketplace, the terrain, the nature of these plants, the consumers are going to be stuck, having paid all these upfront costs, never get a used and useful product anyway, and then the cost of the power coming out of that plant will be too high. So this is a lose-lose situation for consumers, being forced to pay upfront before they ever get them, and if they do happen to get them, they're going to be forced to pay too much for the power coming out of them.
Yeah, as Mark says, the issue isn't who pays, because in the end, the customers do pay. It's who finances the plants. And under the model that's served the U.S. very well for the first 100 years of regulated utility history, the financing was done by banks and by shareholders, borrowed money and advanced capital. And then once the plant went into service, the customers paid it back with a return. Now, in the states where all this is done through markets and the utilities commissions don't have the power to charge customers up front, utilities cannot, or those building nuclear plants cannot charge the customers beforehand. That's Texas, that's Maryland, that's New York, that's Pennsylvania. It's only in the Southeast, really, that the builders retain the capability of charging the customers beforehand, and they do it under this revised legal framework that the Southeastern states have put in place that makes it much easier to shift all of the risk of things going wrong onto the customers. That's why the prudence determinations and the feasibility determinations that are wrapped up in this case are so important. Those are the preconditions and the only customer protections that are left in the system.
Thank you.
Operator, do we have other questions at this time?
Sir, at this time, I'm showing no additional questions.
Let's do this. Since we do have a few minutes, let's go through the instructions one more time about how it is that reporters can pose their questions. We do want to make sure that anyone who's on the call who's not yet posed a question, and there are several of you who have not indicated a preference one way or the other about posing the question now or later, has the opportunity to do so. So, operator, one more time with the instructions.
If you would like to ask a question, please press star and 1. If you decide you would like to withdraw your question, you may press star and then 2 to remove yourself from the queue. Again, in order to ask a question, it is star and 1.
And while we're waiting to see if there will be any final questions, I do want to make sure that you know that you can make arrangements after this news event is over to speak to Leslie Anderson at 703-276-3256. Again, that's Leslie Anderson at 703-276-3256. She can put you in touch with any of the speakers that you've heard from today. She can also get you a copy of the related news release, the Mark Cooper report from earlier this year that he referred to about the economics of nuclear reactors, all that available by contacting Leslie Anderson directly, 703-276-3256. You can find the related news release on the web at cleanenergy.org. Again, that's www.cleanenergy.org. That's the website for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. That's also where you'll be able to hear a streaming audio replay of this news event. That will be available to you as of 4 p.m. Eastern Time today, October 14th, 2009. Streaming audio replay may be useful to you in the event that you missed a portion of the call or you want to hear some portion of the call over again. So feel free to check that out. The website itself, again, has the news release and also contains the contact information for Leslie Anderson, who can put you in touch with the experts. Operator, I understand we have no additional questions at this time?
That is correct.
Okay. So what we will do with our brief remaining time is we'll go back through our three speakers and allow each one of them to offer closing thoughts, any point that they would like to underscore or amplify before we wrap things up. We'll go back through our speakers in the order that you heard them first present their remarks. That takes us, first of all, to Sara Barzac, who is Program Director with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy.
Thank you. SACE is just extremely concerned as to what has been going on in Florida over the last several years at the Public Service Commission, where energy efficiency and renewables have been ignored, and these high-cost, high-risk new nuclear power plant proposals are moving forward, first in the legislature and then via the Public Service Commission. It is very important that the Public Service Commissioners this Friday vote to protect the ratepayers, the customers of Florida Power and Light and Progress, from bad decisions that the utilities are making in terms of ignoring significant changes that Dr. Cooper and Mr. Bradford referred to on the call and also in their testimony. This is a chance to just slow down the process. It does not mean the PSC would be saying no to new reactors in Florida. And we feel very strongly that before excessive costs are spent on these new projects, that these projects need to be slowed down by the PSC, and they can do that this Friday by voting to reject the utility's request. Thank you.
That was the closing thought for today from Sara Barzac, Program Director for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. We'll now proceed to the individual who delivered the second opening statement. His name, Mark Cooper, Senior Fellow for Economic Analysis at the Institute for Energy and the Environment at Vermont Law School.
I would reiterate what Sara said in a slightly different way. Now is the moment to step out of line, to step aside, to wait, to gather more information, to understand what the structure of the future electricity market will be. The decline in demand has given the state that opportunity. The inability of the projects to find partners suggests that other utilities that did not commit to these projects are holding back. They are reevaluating the next decade or two. All of the factors we've mentioned suggest that this is not a good idea. It doesn't make any sense to spend this money today. Nothing says you can't get back in line at some point in the future if you can actually demonstrate the need and the fact that these reactors will be the lowest cost alternative. The likelihood that that is the case is very slim. So now is the moment to stop spending ratepayers' money on projects that are likely to go bad or cost much too much.
That was the closing thought for today from Mark Cooper, Senior Fellow for Economic Analysis at the Institute for Energy and the Environment at Vermont Law School. And that takes us to the third speaker that you heard at the beginning of this news conference, Peter Bradford, former Nuclear Regulatory Commission member and former chair of the New York and Maine Utility Commissions. He's also the adjunct professor at Vermont Law School.
Well, the power to impose these early cost recovery charges is essentially a power to tax. That is, the state government shifting set of costs from the people who normally would bear them onto someone else, in this case, Florida's utility customers. And it's an expensive tax because of the very high cost of the plants in question. The law that allows it also requires demonstrations that the project is prudent, that it makes sense, that it's feasible. And the Florida utilities really have not made that showing in light of all the changes that have occurred in the year since the determination of need was made. In fact, Progress Energy in particular has been pretty cavalier about its obligation to take these changes into account. So it's really incumbent on the commission not to impose charges like this until the utilities can justify fully, in light of a realistic assessment of these changes, that there is justification for the plants. And they certainly haven't done that yet. The commission ought not to be imposing these charges until they do.
So that was the final thought for today from our third of three speakers who spoke at the beginning of this news conference, Peter Bradford, adjunct professor at Vermont Law School, former Nuclear Regulatory Commission member, and also a former chair of the New York and Maine Utility Commissions. You've been listening to a news event sponsored by the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. More information available to you on the web at www.cleanenergy.org. Again, that's cleanenergy.org. Information about speakers and the information related to today's news event available to you by contacting Leslie Anderson at 703-276-3256. Again, that's Leslie Anderson at 703-276-3256. As of 4 p.m. today, October 14, 2009, there will be a streaming audio replay of this news event available on the website for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy at cleanenergy.org. On behalf of the three speakers that you heard from today, as well as everyone else associated with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, we'd like to thank you for joining us. That concludes this news event.